Welcome to Highway to Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. Hope you've had a great couple of weeks. Thanks for all the feedback from the Lauren Cox conversation. I even got a message from Lauren's mom. It's very sweet. And I'm so excited to have Daniel Cohen back on the podcast today, Dr. Dan, to discuss the power of language and self-hypnosis.
How we talk is how we think. How we think is how we feel. And how we feel is how we act.
If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. It's my hope that through these conversations that you hear on Highway to Health, you can make more informed choices in how you build your own blueprint for health and well-being. If you're a regular listener, I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear how you're implementing at least one thing you've received from one of my guests here on the podcast. You can shoot me an email at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. With your help, we'll also be bringing you more resource this year, in our third year, through a website being developed that will have its own search engine for health topics from podcasts, guests, and contributors to a new resource site. As a producer and editor, it is my job to make sure that everything you listen to, watch, and read here on the site is reputable, straight from the source of someone who has dedicated their career to improving our livelihood. If you'd like to help make this project come to life, become a contributor. You can donate for as little as $1 a month. Go to patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And if you want to learn more about the plans we have here in store for this project, or you can check out the 2-minute video of me explaining this on our Patreon page. And just a quick reminder that we're now on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and Buzzsprout, and soon to be on highwaytohealthpodcast.com. So whether you're in need of some inspiration on the drive to work, staying motivated at your desk, underground with your earbuds in on the subway or at the gym, we're here for you. And one more quick thank you to those of you who have taken the time to rate this podcast and comment. Highway to Health is now ranked 122 in health and self-help podcasts in the UK. Strange, but exciting too. So thanks to all of you, all of my UK friends. And I want to share one of the comments that I got this past month. It says, have been extremely impressed with this podcast. Fantastic guests with valuable wisdom and experience. They are excited to share with useful takeaways for me always. I think Jeremy is an excellent interviewer. Unlike many male podcasters, he does not talk over his guests, nor does he mansplain. He communicates a wealth of knowledge from his own work, and his genuine interest in other people's journeys comes through. This really touched me, and I really appreciate it. Thank you for these kind words. You know, working on a podcast is sometimes a solitary business, which suits me for the most part, but it's always great to get this kind of feedback. And everything you said here is something that I've given a great deal of thought to, who the guests are, the takeaways, and making sure I'm not talking over my guests and mansplaining. So thank you for recognizing these things, and I'll do my best to stay on this track. So my guest today is Dr. Daniel Cohen. He's an internationally recognized developmental behavioral pediatrician and an expert educator in clinical hypnosis. He's taught thousands of physicians through the University of Minnesota since 1978. His work focuses on empowering children and teaching them skills before pills, as he's known to say. If you want to learn more about his story and his career, you can go back and listen to our first conversation on the podcast, which is still available through your podcast app. I've been fortunate in my career to work with all ages of people in my practice, from newborns to end of life. I see certain patterns from this, and recently had a thought that kept running through my mind. The topic of belief systems and how they work for us or against us has come up a number of times in conversations here on the podcast. And being that it relates to self-hypnosis, I thought Dr. Dan, as he's affectionately known to his younger clients, would know and have a lot to say about this and bring a lot to the dialogue. While we talked about children in this conversation, there's an aspect of what is discussed here that I know you'll be able to relate to, because many of us are still working through behavioral patterns that stem from our childhoods. Keep your ears tuned for this one. He plants lots of important seeds for us. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Daniel Cohen. What I'm curious about is, you know, I know how you are using hypnotherapy and hypnosis, But I think most people's idea of that is so outdated in the way that it's actually being used in you know, therapeutic treatment. So I'm curious to hear like your background in using it and like a definition that you go by.
Yeah. So several things come to mind. One is I would first I'll tell you the sort of definition that at least I and my associates and people with whom I co-write things or co-teach utilize as a definition, especially when we're teaching other professionals, and ways that I talk with families about it. But it's also curious that just yesterday I had an email from a colleague with this definition, with his definition, asking for my response. And I think it might be interesting to kind of go through that. But so in general, I'm inclined to tell people the definition that I utilize is that hypnosis is a state of mind, a state of consciousness that is either induced or invited, or, you know, now we're having regular conversation and now we're going to do this hypnosis.
Right.
So that's one way of thinking about that, and I'll come back to that.
Okay.
And the other is the acknowledgement, which I think most people are unaware of, that it's a spontaneous state that people move in and out of all day long, mostly as we broaden and then narrow our focus and our concentration.
Yeah.
And when we do that in our natural state, without the word hypnosis, without talking about it, without hearing about it, without being invited, that condition, that state has a lot of the same, some would say all, I would say most of the same characteristics that are operative when people are using this clinical hypnosis for a purpose.
Right.
So it's a state of mind in which there is narrowed focus and concentration on some idea with the purpose of making a change of some kind, achieving a goal, solving a problem, reducing discomfort, reducing anxiety, eliminating a habit, and a myriad of other things that fall in subcategories of that. So that said, it is both a good thing and a not-so-good thing for the field of clinical hypnosis that there is no final agreed-upon scientific definition.
Right.
The good part about that is that it allows people the flexibility and the creativity, the clinician people, the flexibility and the creativity to utilize the concepts in the way that's most appropriate for a given client or patient, rather than this is the way you do it. And that's old style. That's, you know, most of us who do this clinically in a healthcare setting decry the use of the authoritarian image that you would see in commercials in movies, and which you still see in cartoons, where the person who is portrayed as the hypnotist, which is a word we don't use, is often evil, controlling, directive. Try to move your arm. You can't. You'll only listen to my words. Blah blah blah. You know, and to a person, and I'll keep saying this until it stops. When I meet somebody new, and the word hypnosis comes up, and there's a child in the room who's there for help with something, I play dumb, but I really, I just do this because I want to facilitate hearing from them. I say, well, hypnosis, what's that? And sometimes you get an equally snotty response, and they say, well, don't you know you're supposed to be the expert? And I said, no, I'm asking because I'm very interested in what you think, what you've heard, what you know.
Yeah.
And typically to a person, including some adults, they say nothing, but instead one hand or the other goes out in front of them and they dangle an imaginary watch at the end of an imaginary chain.
Yeah.
And sometimes they add words like, you're getting very sleepy. And I laugh and I say, where'd you see that? And they say, oh, I saw it in cartoons. I said, well, what happens next? Well, then the Bugs Bunny or the Roadrunner, their eyes get all swirly, and then they close their eyes, and then they fall off the cliff. Or they go to sleep. And then what? And then he tells them what to do when he wakes them up. And then what? And then he snaps his fingers and they wake up. And then what? And then they go and kill somebody, or they go or they go, you know, give them money, or they go do other sort of unsavory things that they wouldn't ordinarily do.
Right.
None of that is true. None of that is at all operative in the field of clinical hypnosis, where we are teaching people what to do, how to capture their own skills, and to use them for some purpose for which they came in the first place.
Yeah, and we get stuck in this terminology, in these words. I mean, we don't have a better word for it at this point. Maybe, you know, like, we hypnosis, or the idea of what we had. I guess hypnosis still works. It's just that we're so attached to this old way of thinking about what it is that now the word itself means something else to people until they really are informed. Because I think medicine in some ways has changed in the exact same way that we've probably shifted in hypnotherapy, where the authoritarian way of practicing medicine has also changed. You know, that was maybe to some extent why people got involved in different kinds of work. You know, I think there are some people who get very drawn to being police officers because they like the power. They being politicians, right. Same with doctors and lawyers and everybody else. And, you know, there I'm sure was a breed of hypnotherapists who played this role and loved that role. But I think by and large, that was never the case. They were exploring a part of the mind that we were still and are still learning a lot about, but certainly have learned a lot in the last, you know, 60, 70 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. Boy, we could spend 3 hours just on what you just said, but it's, so let me just add something to that. I think there are still people who come to doctor people, helper people, who come to hypnosis courses with mistaken ideas, and that's why part of our training curricula emphasize demythification and demystification and what's really the case and what isn't. So a word about the words. You know, hypnosis, the Greek word hypnos is the origin of the word hypnosis and hypnotism and hypnotist and these kinds of words. But it's a Greek word that means sleep. Mm-hmm. And nothing could be further from the truth, except that one good, really good thing about hypnosis skills is that it's a very, very easy way to help people who have a problem with insomnia.
Yeah.
So it can absolutely facilitate falling asleep easily. But hypnosis,
on the other side of that, it's actually about waking up.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the other interesting part.
Yeah. It's about enhanced awareness, focused concentration.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, I don't hypnotize anybody. It's not a verb except reflexively. So I know how to hypnotize myself. And mm-hmm. and I say this to patients, that if you want to learn how to hypnotize yourself, if you have a reason that you want to learn this skill that you already have but you don't know that you have, then I can show you. Because you know, it's all about words and definitions. What does the word doctor mean? I even ask this to my colleagues who are doctors, and often I get answers that are not true to the dictionary. Mm. They say healer. I said, well, we would hope that doctors are healers, but the word physician means healer, but the word doctor means teacher. Mm. PhD is a doctor of philosophy in geology, science, zoology, botany,
right.
You know, whatever. And doctor of medicine, MD, doctor of medicine, is teacher of medicine. That's my job. And I'm sorry to say that a lot of physicians still believe, independent of hypnosis, still believe, and which is why patients still believe this, they go to the doctor and the doctor tells them what to do. And they do what they say. Yeah. I meet lots of people, less now than 20 years ago, who have X, Y, or Z problem, and they are told by their doctor to take X, Y, or Z medicine, and they take it. And I say, oh, so you're taking that? Yeah. How long have you been taking it? 2 years. Does it help? Nope. But you're still taking it? Yeah, well, the doctor said to.
Yeah.
I said, well, so let's get something straight in our emerging relationship. I may have some ideas for you to consider, but if they don't work, I want you to tell me, and I don't want you to do them.
Yeah.
If they don't help you, please tell me, and we'll figure out something that does work together. Because this is, and that's another way from the get-go in sort of driving the partnership that healthcare should really be.
Right.
So back to the definition. I really want to... let me go back to the word for a moment. Many years ago, more than 35 years ago, when my colleagues and I wrote this paper, which still stands as the largest series of patients, child patients treated with hypnosis. There were over 500. We just kept track of serially of the patients we saw and what the outcomes were. And we decided when we published the paper that we were going to call it, we were going to do our best to figure out different nomenclature. What could this be called? Mm-hmm. And so we said, self-hypnosis training, parentheses, relaxation and mental imagery, to provide a new synonym that we would then use repeatedly, at least whatever hoping that it would catch on and we would use this in teaching and so on. Well, it didn't particularly catch on, but we still continue to use it, and the abbreviation RMI. And why that? Because those seem to be the operative features of the clinical hypnosis experience, at least with children, and I think with adults too. Although relaxation is not mandated or required. There are plenty of people who spend a lot of their professional lives in a hypnotic state, professional athletes, dancers, singers, actors, you know, who take on a different persona. They're different who they are when they're in that role.
Right.
And they can tell you. They can tell you in focus that what they do to batters that go into a slump in baseball, go see a therapist, and they learn some self-hypnosis skills, and their batting average jumps 60, 70 points.
Right.
Because they learn those skills. And now, most, even college teams and even some high school teams, as well as the pros and Olympic teams, have a sports psychologist or equivalent who teaches those imagery skills to their patients. They're not their patients, to their team.
Right, right.
And they're deigned to call it hypnosis. They it's guided imagery. It's and they have all sorts of names for it. And some of it, even when it's good, some of it is problematic from our clinical perspective because it may be scripted.
Right.
And the only script that's appropriate is the script that I co-write with my patient.
Right.
In an ongoing real time fashion.
Well, and it's the challenge that you would face with anyone who's trying to seek this kind of training in a group setting too, I think. You know,
right.
there are aspects that you can do in a group setting once you've gone through the introductory phase of something, but to you know, have a rote way of sort of teaching somebody hypnosis or meditation in a group setting makes it a lot more difficult when you really need to get that understanding of that person. And this is kind of getting into what I think, you know, you and I have been talking about a little bit, which is that if you don't understand this person's, you know, point of view or their belief system around, you know, how they become well or how they stay well, then where do you start?
Exactly. And that's where you start, rather than sometimes, I don't get this question very often, but sometimes the child is connected to where I'm going and what I'm talking about, even in the first visit, and the parent is sitting kind of tapping their foot and looking around and looking at their clock and at their watch and wondering. And sometimes they will say, not very often, well, when are we going to get to the hypnosis? And I'm very sort of incredulous about that. I usually say, well, if we decide we're going to do this thing called hypnosis, it's only going to happen after we get to know each other and we understand what the goals are, what the problem has been, what's good about it, what's bad about it, and so on. And most of the time, that's sufficient to satisfy that urgency that comes out of, we're tired of this symptom, this problem, we want help, we've been to 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever others. And thankfully, in 2019, I am no longer very often the last stop on the line.
Right.
Much more often, I get the referral from the primary care physician day one or day two, and because I know them, or I've been in the community a long time and so on. But in the old days, it was like, oh, we've been to so many people. How long have you had this problem? 2 years, 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, and I'm thinking the same thing they're thinking was, I wish I had met you sooner.
Yeah.
And sometimes people say that.
Because you get the sort of difference, The documentary you suggested that I watch, Heal, that you can watch it on Netflix, anyone who's listening that is interested in this, but kind of gets into this whole idea of belief system. And one of the things that you were talking about with that is this, you know, the diagnosis versus the prognosis. And it's such a powerful thing because it really does matter where we enter into the conversation with them. If the prognosis has become their belief system once they get to us, meaning that if the you know, therapist or physician or whoever is working with them says, well, this is the problem, this is what you can expect, you know, this is the timeline, that kind of stuff, that starts to, it's almost like, you know, being a witch doctor. You've now set these pieces into this person's brain, and those have to be changed then.
And there's many pieces to that, sad to say. And I spend a lot of time thinking about that because I've been an educator for a long time. And, you know, what people bring to the table is so, so important. So the most doctors who do that with their patients, what you were just describing, do it good-heartedly.
Yeah, right.
The intention is, I want to tell the truth. So full disclosure, driven in part by insurance companies and lawyers who have nothing else to do, but with good intention, and they will defend it.
And looking at the research that and their experience, they're trying
most of the time people that and they don't want to mislead people who and have them come back and say, well, you never told me that this could happen, and so on.
So it's self protective too.
I must tell you, at the risk of saying this to a public audience, when I do prescribe medicines, and I do, I'm a physician, and sometimes I prescribe medication when it's appropriate, but my general attitude is skills before pills, and most people are quite content with that.
Yeah.
But when I do prescribe it, I tell them, I wouldn't prescribe something to you that wasn't safe. Here's what you can expect from it, but everybody's different, so we really won't know until you start using it. But the rule on this medicine is start low, go slow. I want to hear from you. This is not, here's a prescription, call me in 6 months. I don't work that way. And when you pick this up at the pharmacy, it's going to come in a bottle, and there's going to be a circular inside of it on paper with about 4 or 6 point font. And it's going to be hard to read, and some people need a magnifying glass, but I suggest you don't even bother reading it. If you decide to read it anyway, my absolute rule is call me if you don't understand a word, and call me if you don't understand anything in it or if it scares you or whatever.
Yeah. Or if you can't remember, because sometimes, you know, you walk out, you're kind of in a daze from, you're not quite sure why you're even
right.
Being prescribed something, and you go to the pharmacy and you're kind of, I mean, you know, your stress response might be a little up. That's going to cloud your brain a little bit. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, am I supposed to eat something with this? So, you know, and you need to have that. I mean, I actually think that's an amazing thing that you do that and really kind of go through that with people. Because I think too many times people don't feel like they can reach back out again and say, I'm sorry, I totally spaced this thing. I can't remember.
Well, no, I insist that people know, and I'm at the end of every first visit, every child and each parent get my card, and I point out what the phone number is, what the fax number is, what the email is, and that I expect to hear from them if they have any questions. There's no such thing as a dumb question. I'll go over everything as many times as you want. The goal is for us to be on the same page. And sometimes it takes, because people seem to want it or need it, a moment or two of explanation of why these circulars are made, that it comes out of federal law intended to protect people, both the company and the taker of the medicine. And for reasons that I wasn't around to understand when these laws were created, they are required to put in the circular the results of every experiment they ever did with any guinea pig or rat or mouse in a laboratory long before these were ever used in people and tested and found to be safe. So the reality is I can't promise you, just because I only prescribe things that I know to be safe and tell you that you take it the way I recommend, because it's not true that if one is good, two is twice as good. It's just not true. And so... You know, if you notice something that you don't understand or that you didn't think would happen, like if you get a nose, extra nose growing out of the top of your head, you should call me so we can discuss that. You could even stop the medicine before you call me.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to the definition, because I really want to read this thing that I just got in the mail from a colleague who is always thinking about hypnosis and ways to define it. So he wrote me this, and he said, I'm going to be giving two talks, one to parents in a few days and another one at a course at a university whose name I shall leave out in a couple of months. And so playing with this week's definition of hypnosis, is there anything you'd like to add or to ask?
Yeah.
So he says, quote, hypnosis is a language-based, permissive, relational skill set evoking sensory absorption and promoting an attention shift away and from reasoning and rumination and toward curiosity and new possibilities using naturalistic suggestibility. That's all one sentence. And you said, and you're right, I thought about it. So I wrote back, interspersing in my words in a different color amidst the different parts of that sentence.
Yeah.
And I said, in relation to a language-based permissive, I said, well, some hypnosis work is defined by the needs of the patient or the client, more in adults than in children, but true in some of each, is particularly permissive as some patients' and clients' needs and demeanor seem to require. But others require a very directive or even authoritative approach, which is hearkening back to the way it's portrayed in films. It's not that we think that's terrible for everyone.
Yeah.
It's that we think that that, as a starting point for everyone, is a serious mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
And that in the context of developing a rapport and relationship with somebody, some people, for whatever reason in their background, their culture, their family, have no initiative.
Right.
And need to be told what to do, at least to get started.
That was always been my take too, is that I call it like the hand holding period.
Exactly.
You know, where it's like I want to empower this person, but they're sometimes in such a powerless place that if I don't step up and really direct that beginning, we're not going to get anywhere either.
Perfect. And it's all about empowerment. And everybody does that and has that in a different way.
Right.
And some you see that it's already there and you can skip that step. So here's the rest of it. Relational skill set, I responded by saying, I wonder if a skill set per se can be permissive and authoritarian, rather how it's taught may be permissive or authoritarian, and is that then the skill set of the clinician and not of the recipient? So I wrote that mostly to be provocative for him. And then he said, evoking sensory absorption or promoting an attention shift away from reasoning and rumination toward curiosity. I told him this whole turn of a phrase was from evoking all the way to the end is great, and it's a really accurate description of what I hope and desire to happen. Using naturalistic suggestibility, I wondered with him about the meaning of naturalistic, which seems to reference the patient's suggestibility. And I think it might work better if you were going to write it down to say utilizing the patient's or subject's naturally occurring suggestibility, which is, by the way, independent of healthcare, something used very well by marketing people and used car salesmen and and the guys on late night television cable who are selling God knows what, standing behind a mahogany desk and a big bookshelf of very important looking books, and how they look and how they dress and how they speak is every bit a piece of playing to what they understand to be the suggestibility of the audience.
Right, yeah.
Which is why from a historical perspective, you probably know this, but I don't know if the audience will know. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in the early days of television, late 50s, early 60s, became aware that some TV people were putting advertising in a blink of an eye.
Yeah. Just a flash.
As a flash.
You wouldn't even see it.
Not even noticed by the discerning eye.
Yeah.
But slow down the recording of that, and they would find it. And then they outlawed it because it was considered to be inappropriate, subliminal advertising and manipulation.
Yeah. which still goes on in all sorts of other ways.
It does go on, you know, sad to say. But yeah. So I thought that was very interesting and very timely. I'll have to tell him that he contributed to a podcast and by his definition.
But there's it's interesting. Given that, could you take me through like what that beginning phase is, you know, with a person when you're information gathering, and then how you start to bring the hypnosis part of it, or you know, teach self hypnosis or whatever it is with that.
So it's also very timely. I don't believe in coincidences particularly. It's nice this is happening now, because I don't remember if it was earlier this week or end of last week, but I met a new patient who is 10 years old. They came from several hours' drive away. This child's background is that he happened to be adopted when he was late in his first year of life, a little bit late for an adoption, a foreign adoption, and he was about 8 months of age. He's the only child of a more than middle-aged couple, and clearly a very loved and lovely child. Now is he 10 or 11? Maybe he's 11. And would that be right? Maybe he's 12. He's 12. And I heard on the phone he was referred by the pediatrician who had seen him just once and who knew that this problem was out of her league.
Yeah.
And talked to somebody else who both of us know, and that somebody else suggested she call me, and she called me and we talked about it and then referred them here. And so he has a problem with ticks.
Okay.
Not the biting kind that live on dogs, but but the twitching kind.
Yeah.
TICS, not TICKS. And they began 4 years earlier when he was 8.
Okay.
Out of the blue.
Behavioral or physical or how?
Physical.
Okay.
Eye blinking, began as eye blinking, and went to see a neurologist at a famous place that shall remain nameless, and they were told that they needed all sorts of tests, and so they did all sorts of tests, and predictably, especially in retrospect, predictably the tests were all normal. I have no idea if their insurance paid for it or if it cost them a lot of money, but they would have been really expensive tests, yeah. MRI, brain scan, various blood tests, and all normal. And the explanation was that they had to do all of those because they didn't have any biologic family history and they needed to have biologic.
Okay.
So short of that, needed to do all these tests. Well, I happen to disagree, but this is not medical science. Good medicine is both art and science,
right.
Not one or the other. So, and I have to work very hard to not be judgmental, especially about things that are water over the dam. You know, I mean, it's like, it's done. So,
right. Yeah.
Well, what did that doctor say to do? Well, nothing, just to wait. And that had been about 4 months into having the tics.
Okay.
And the message was apparently sufficiently reassuring in the sense that it's just eye blinking and much of these often go away. And that's true, except when they don't go away.
Right.
And they didn't. And then...
And every parent's going to worry
that
that's never going to change.
Exactly. And the longer it goes, and then they get hope because they do disappear for a while, and then they come back. And sometimes what disappears is the original eye blinking, and a different kind of tic appears, facial grimacing or shoulder shrugging or head nodding, head bobbing, various other things. And soon he also began to make some vocalizations that were unusual and thankfully not real loud and thankfully not obscene words, which can happen with his particular condition. And so they sought some other, quote, cures, went to see a naturopath who said, I don't know what this is, I don't know if these will help, but try some of this, and gave several so-called natural healing things to take.
Yeah.
Some vitamins, some other supplements, and I said, how'd that go?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't like taking them, and they didn't do anything, so we stopped. They said, good, that was the smart thing to do. Did you tell them that? No, we didn't tell them, but we didn't go back. Oh, okay. Right. What'd you think then? Well, I didn't know what to think. So I said, it was really smart to seek another opinion, and the doctor that you went to was new for you, but was she nice to you? I already knew this, that she was good.
Yeah.
And yes, she was, and she said that she talked to you, and she said that you were very optimistic on the phone, and so I was hopeful. So that's always what I'm going for,
right,
if I have the opportunity to, you know, that's not always there. Sometimes it's go see this guy, he'll help you, which is better than he could help, I don't know.
Right, you know? Yeah.
So while we were talking, it's always my intention that rapport comes first, and in the context of rapport, mm-hmm, to begin to provide shifts in language,
yeah,
shifts in frame of reference. No conversation about hypnosis until and unless they bring it up, or until unless I think it's timely to bring it up. And that almost never happens at a first visit, even though I meet with people for an hour and a half, the first encounter. But I do start making shifts in language. And when they notice it, I say, so you probably noticed that I'm interrupting you from time to time and suggesting that instead of trying, we do, and instead of can't, we say can't, haven't yet.
Yeah,
and things like that. And I said, here's the reason. How we talk is how we think. How we think is how we feel. And how we feel is how we act. Another word for act is behave.
Right.
Although kids usually hear the word behave attached to don't behave that way.
Right.
But behavior is what we do all the time, right? And so our actions come from our feelings, and those come from our thinking, and those come from how we talk. So if we want to change an action, a behavior, whatever it is, an itch, a pain, a habit, whatever, it starts by how we talk about it. That then has a fighting chance to change how we think about it. Mm-hmm. And when we change how we think about it, we can begin to change how we feel, and then we can begin to change how we behave and act. And you, when I say that, people get this kind of aha look on their face. Although there's nothing magical about it, and I don't pretend I might be one of the only people who says that way, but I didn't invent it.
Right.
It just came to me. I don't think I ever read it anywhere.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it came to me as something, and as long as it's working, I'm going to continue saying that. So that was there. Now, what happened as we were talking, I began to hear more about this, and I'm like, so who knows about this? Because I'm going for what you said earlier about, well, what's the culture of this? People, it's not just a person and their condition or their problem.
Right.
They live in a family. The family lives in a community. Kids have different kinds of communities. They have the neighborhood. They have the school community. They have their church or other faith community.
And now they're social media communities.
Exactly. And so do other people, well, you know, my mom knows, my dad knows. Well, my teacher knows, but she's really good. And the mother says, no, your teacher is awesome. So, note to self, I've learned something really important about another source of how to help this kid. He's already got that. The teacher is awesome. So I check with the mother. The teacher does not call attention. The teacher notices some of the tick behaviors, but these vocalizations that the child has are terrible and loud, but only at home.
Mm.
So I asked him about that. I said, so really, this mostly at home with the noises? Yeah. How come? And he said to me, he's only 12, and he's kind of a not near puberty 12.
Yeah.
It's better, I think,
to
be later in puberty than earlier, just in general, for the kid, for the family, for everybody. Yeah. But he's a young 12.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, kind of, I don't hear that too much from 12-year-olds. You know, is like, I know how to think.
Right.
You know,
I've given this a fair amount of consideration.
Yeah. And you know, most 12-year-olds don't have a conscience. They're not supposed to, you know, and they haven't learned abstract reasoning yet.
Yeah.
But this boy has it. And he says, well, you know, I think it's those sounds come out at home because I know that's where I'm loved.
Wow.
Oh my God. Yeah, wow is right. And even saying that, it touches me. I remember kind of taking a breath and saying, good for you. Yeah. I said, that's right. And the mother was near tears already just hearing that. Yeah. She hadn't heard that from him. And it really changed the way she could think about it. And I after I settled down from my own being choked up about it, I said, you're probably right. On the other hand, it probably bothers them.
Bothers them that
the parents hearing those sounds and coming out of the blue,
or they worry that it's something that in their own behavior or their relationship dynamic that might be bringing it out.
Yeah, and I said, but it probably doesn't bother them as much as it bothers you.
Right. Yeah.
And he just kind of nodded his head. He didn't speak, but he's like, and what I got from that is, you're getting what I'm going for, which is that this work doesn't happen over there or over here. It happens in between us, back and forth.
Yeah.
And so then, I don't know, I trust my intuition when I'm working with patients. And so it came to mind to revisit the history, and which I always do when there's been onset at a time that doesn't really make any sense.
Right.
So I said, your mom has probably already thought a great deal about this, but this started when you were 8, right?
Yep.
What else started when you were 8 besides being 8? You went from 7 to being 8. How was 8 compared to 7? Oh, it was better. Hmm. Yeah, because you're getting older, growing up.
Yeah.
And then when did this start? And he told me, and I said, well, you know, just woke up one day and your eyes were blinking. You know, and they checked with the doctor to make sure there wasn't an infection or an allergy or whatever.
But yeah.
That common response to that, appropriate common response.
Yeah.
And so then I asked him and his mother, what are the standard kinds of questions? Well, either then or before then by a month or two, was there any big change in the family? Did you move? No, was there? So first open-ended, then closed-ended questions. You know, did you move? Was there a death in the family? Was there? Did you get a new pet? Did best friend move to Texas? Negative on all of this, right? And you don't know anybody else in your. You know anything about the biologic family, so you don't know if there were these problems in any of those people.
Yeah.
But how about the current family? No, nobody. Because sometimes habitual behaviors develop for all sorts of reasons.
Right.
They may be imitative behaviors of other people. They may be something you saw on TV, whatever. And often we never find out. So then I said, I really did say this, said to him, because I wanted to plant a seed before we did anything formal. I said, so let me understand this. So this started when you were 8.
Yeah.
So, and now you're 12. Right. So for 8 years, no tics. Right?
Yeah.
And 4 years, some tics. Right.
Hmm.
So I often use my hands out in front of me, palms up, as a way of describing what I'm going to say verbally. So I said, so in that computer called the brain, there's a small file down here called tics with a small amount of memory, 4 years.
Yeah.
And he nods, yeah. And in another part of that computer we call the brain, there's a very large file, twice as large, 8 years worth of memory, called no tics. Right? And he did what you were doing, which is he nodded and he shifted into a different state of mind with focus. His facial muscles got relaxed. He nodded his head. He didn't blink his eyes as much, you know. And I said, so really, all we have to do to begin to solve this problem is to figure out how to delete that smaller file and open the bigger file and use it. And that's what he did. He nodded his head. And then I said, I am 100% sure that I can teach you how to do that, but probably not today because we're running out of time. And that was the seed.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him a second time yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I know that seed's going to grow. And if I need to, mechanistically speaking, tell the mother that's precisely what I had in mind and what I was doing with that phrase was planting a seed.
Yeah.
And yes, that's a metaphor for seeds grow, provided we water them properly and take out the weeds that grow and make sure if the wind blows them away that we replant them. And yes, that's a story about a seed in a tree, but ideas grow too, and they grow to the solution, toward the solution. I always ask people, and somehow I see the question bubbling up in your mind about, well, wait a minute, is that hypnosis? And the answer is yes. So I always ask, and I asked him, and I'll probably ask him again. I said, so these ticks and these noises, is there anything good about them? No. Well, I never ask the question if I think that the answer is going to be yes. But I want to hear, and I want him to hear himself say no. So, and do you need them for anything? No. Definitive.
Yeah.
Exclamation point. Are you going to miss them when they're gone?
Hmm.
So the key words there, and when I make my notes, the key words are written in capital letters, miss, when, gone.
Okay.
Those are the words I want the inner mind to hear.
Right.
You're going to miss them? No, why would I miss them? I said, look, I'm not fighting with you. I'm glad that you won't miss them. But here's the deal. I always ask kids these questions because if you need them for something, if you're going to miss them when they're gone, if they serve some meaning, some function, they're good in some way, then I don't want to help you with them. It would be a waste of my time and yours.
Yeah.
So then they get it. Plus, the underneath message that I'm going for, and I don't have to explain it, is I want you to know the how come about what we're doing. This is not mysterious.
Yeah, right. And the other really, important thing that I think you did in this situation is you also created this image that you must have somehow picked up that he would understand a computer, which they're 12 years old.
Oh, yeah, I already know. He plays video games. Thank you.
Right, right. Yeah. So now you've got this image that he can now work with too.
And, exactly.
And that also now becomes a construct that probably trumps the whatever else the old construct was on some level, or at least does battle with that construct.
Right, right.
Yeah, then there is the part that I think is really also really smart, which is, and I'm sure you deal with certain kinds of things like this, where when you ask the question of a behavioral problem, I'm not going to get my wording right, I'm sure, but if they would, miss that thing, or if this is something that they want to keep, there may be certain, behavioral things that the kid actually does like that the parent doesn't like.
Right.
And so then I'm sure there's got to be some kind of negotiation that goes on as far as how that serves the ecosystem or,
right.
the child themselves.
And of course that just goes back to every kid and every family is different. And that's not the way, I was involved in medical education for 35 years
yeah.
and still am in another way in teaching these hypnosis workshops. But if we teach only this is the way it's done, then we're going to be very, very unhappy because it's not going to work. It's not one size fits all.
Yeah.
We have to be creative and flexible and do what fits for the person. The one that always comes to my mind about this is many years ago when I was first doing this work, I've been maybe, 3-4 years. So we're talking 35 years ago. And And we were beginning to develop teaching programs and hypnosis workshops and whatever. So we wanted to have videotapes of our work in order to demonstrate this is fine to talk about it, but here's how it looks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had engaged a professional videographer who was going to do this, and I was going to do this. What were we doing it through a one-way? Well, he was filming through a one-way mirror, I guess. It was a one-way window, whatever you call those.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was studio-like in its, and I was on a roll. This girl was 11 years old. She was a great, quote-unquote, great subject. She had asthma. She had learned self-hypnosis techniques to help her asthma. And I'm like, okay, so what's been happening in your life lately? Because we want to talk about what kind of imagery we might use for this, and it's going to be on video after all. And she said, well, I've been practicing a lot on my French horn, and because we have a concert coming up. And I said, oh, well, should I talk about that in the hypnosis? Oh, yeah, sure. And okay, great. So go ahead and get started. And she goes right into hypnosis, and she's sitting there, and she's so relaxed and so comfortable. She's got this almost beatific smile on her face, you know. And,
yeah.
And I'm on a roll. I'm talking about, you know, you can picture yourself there in the rehearsal room, and every note sounds perfectly great, and your fingers are moving the right way on the instrument, and you hear the tone in your ears, and that goes right to your mind, and it goes back to your hands, and you're playing very well, and now you're on stage, and the orchestra is introduced, and if you look out, you can spot your parents there, and you're so happy, and they're smiling, and you play very well, and maybe you have a solo, I don't know, you'll know, and da da da, and off I go, right? And she's just totally calm and wonderful, and we finish, with the applause of the orchestra and everybody, smiles and bows and whatever, and now I'm going to wrap up the video with the debriefing of the hypnosis. So are you all back alert now here in the room? And how was the concert? She says, you know, I went to the beach. And I said, right, that was really good that you went to the beach. Tell me about that. And then she did. I was there. My friends were there. We were on the beach. We had a sandwich. We had the boombox playing. We went swimming, came back, dried up. I said, and all the while, you could hear me speaking, and you just tuned it out and paid attention to the beach. That was really smart. And she said, yeah. I said, so,
but equally as positive an experience for her.
A wonderfully positive experience for her. And the teaching piece of that, which I only was able to start using years later, was if you really want to know, if you're working on something particularly of psychological import, and not so much learning to manage symptoms as she was doing with her asthma, and you want to be sure your patient is with you hypnotically, especially if they're not comfortable. She was comfortable. I said, then you don't make the mistake that I made, which is going off on your own chant, even though you think it's wonderful, and you don't have any evidence in front of you that she's feeling badly or unpleasant. She's not squirming around. She's not opening her eyes and coming out, whatever that means.
Yeah.
So the message is that, and this is what we teach, that you have to have ways of communicating with your patient while they're in this hypnosis stuff, and they can perfectly well talk, and they can perfectly well have their eyes open, and if it helps them to be in hypnosis to have their eyes closed, they can come seemingly alert, but not really, and have what we know to be alert hypnosis,
right,
which is all around us all the time, and converse, and then add to the experience, and then go back to where they were before.
Mm-hmm.
That has a name. That's called fractionation. Not all the way out of the hypnosis, but back in, out. And very useful, particularly for people who are doing intense psychotherapy with their hypnosis.
But also could be helpful for anybody. I mean, if let's say you're a sports player and you're going to go in and out all the time throughout.
Exactly.
You got to step into the huddle and listen to what the coach has to say, and then you got to get back in your, you know, flow.
And when you're having a solo in an orchestra.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
when you have a soliloquy in a play, and then you have to be in a different state of mind when you're quiet and the other people have lines.
Right, right.
So, yeah, good example.
And that's, you know, that's what was the subtitle of that research piece you did early in your career? Again, it was self-hypnosis,
relaxation and mental imagery.
Relaxation and mental imagery, because
yeah, so RMI, yeah.
Because I think that's one of those pieces that I feel like I deal with a lot in the work I do with, you know, say people with they could come in with any condition. It could be they might have ringing in their ears, or they might have chronic pain, or they might just right. be, you know, suffering from a lifelong of anxiety with all sorts of things. It's the same, to me, it feels like the same kind of that autonomic, you know, response or whatever it is, there's some trigger that's just, you know, something's switched on, and there we have to find different mechanisms for how we're going to manage that. You know, for some people, meditation might be a piece of the puzzle, but the self-hypnosis part of things is really, it gets deeper into, you know, I think that the relationship with the self on, you know, maybe primary, but, right. but again, like you're saying, it really kind of gets deeper into the family, into the family's history, and to be able to kind of make, you know, make peace, or, you know, be able to, you know, understand how to relax within that. I mean, why do people drink so much when they go to Thanksgiving with their families? You know, I think part of it is that they're trying to solve that piece for themselves, you right. know, with the dynamics of their family story.
And that, you know, that particular example starts long before Thanksgiving arrives.
Yes.
When they
oh,
start anticipating, you know, is Aunt Martha going to be herself this like she was last year?
right.
And what's Grandpa going to do? And what about my cousins? They're hellions, and you know, and everything in between. And that expectation,
yeah,
supersedes. I deal with that all the time. I almost at the, I don't know, sometimes at the end, sometimes earlier in the first visit, not so much in subsequent visits. Often say to kids and to parents, so when you were thinking about coming here, what did you think was going to happen here? So, you know, the I don't know is the first words out of every child's mouth. And my usual answer to I don't know is, yes, you do.
Hmm.
So this isn't the place where we're giving grades on the answers. This isn't the place where you have a time limit. In school, if you say I don't know, you can get away with it because then they go to the other kid.
Yeah.
Oh, Susie, Michael, Joshua, you know. But here, it's like I know that you know. It's okay if it's not precisely correct. That's not yeah. what I'm looking for.
Right.
I'm interested in what you think. And most of the time, parents say things like, well, kind of what we've been doing, that you kind of get to know us, find out about the problem, what it is, what it isn't. And I said, because I was really wondering if it ever crossed your mind before you came, if you thought that you were going to come in here with the problem and go out without the problem. And they kind of get this sheepish grin on their face, and they say, well, sort of. I said, well, wouldn't that be nice? I said, it's not magic, and I'm not magic, but I do have, you know, I do have a magic wand, and I pull this off the shelf, and
yeah.
I say, when I was seeing Harry Potter as a patient, he came by, and he brought this, and he said I could have this. So let's see if it works. And I go, I said, so, okay, problem done, bye. And so, you know, usually I get this kind of quizzical look, but I don't get it, and I don't do that until we're near the end of the visit, because, and if the visit has not gone the way any of us wanted it to, then I'm not going to do that.
Right, yeah.
But far more often than not, that injects a little bit of humor, and it also calls some reality to the fact that we all, when we have a problem, and we decide we're going to go see somebody about it. Number one, we've made up our mind that it's important enough to go see somebody.
Yeah.
Number two, that we're so tired of this that we're going to go see somebody and we hope they can help. We heard that they might. And yes, we do have a fantasy that it'll help so good that it's like going to the emergency room, getting a broken arm, putting a cast or a cut stitched up or a sore throat, you know, get a shot and it's all better, yeah, or yeah. God forbid, you know. And of course, it's not like that. So I'm putting the fantasy where it belongs. It's okay to have it, but it's not really true. And I often add that, you know, next time when you come, now that we know each other, we can get into learning some ways to you things you can do to help yourself. And most people, and I don't say this just to say it, it's yeah. really true. Most people are surprised how fast things start to change when they learn what they can do. And I'm sticking with you. I'm the coach, but I can't come to your house every night, and I can't call you on the phone every night. And there's certain things you're going to have to do, and we'll get into that next time. So that's more seed planting about how it's going to go.
The place that I'm at with some of the work that I'm doing, and the reason that I wanted to have this conversation with you, is that I think there's an aspect of these things unaddressed that, you know, we build in such a strong structure, mentally, physiologically, even when I say physiologically, I'm thinking a little bit more nervous system wise, but the yeah. way that the way that we sort of program this into our daily activities, that if we have a certain problem that we haven't been able to overcome, or that we have developed this belief system from an early age, and I hear this a lot of times with people who are coming from a family with, you know, say an alcoholic parent, a family where there's been a lot of emotional or sometimes physical abuse, or where they had an early illness. Maybe they had asthma as a child, or they had allergies that were really severe, and they start to develop this belief system because all the adults are starting to say all these things, you know, about whatever the circumstances, that they now can't, you know, change the language for themselves.
Right.
And
yet.
And, you know, it's one of those things that I think you have so much insight into from working with children. But what I see in these adults, you know, it doesn't matter what their age is. I can see that those childhood difficulties in this construct as being the number one. Certainly, it seems to me, anyways.
Yeah.
Like it's probably the number one, you know, challenge that they face.
Yeah, and it may be important to find that out, and it may not. I often, you know, so back to the example of the kid whose tic started when he was eight. I don't know why they started when they were eight. We do know that they're. And I don't want to spend much time on this. We do know that there are some conditions. The fancy name is PANDAS, which you may have heard, which is an autoimmune kind of phenomenon that can happen, where tics and full-blown Tourette syndrome can begin in response to a strep infection. And it's not very common, but it does happen. And you have to have careful documentation biologically in order to prove it. But it can be proven by proper blood studies about did you really have a strep infection or didn't you, or was the strep throat that was positive a positive culture of you being a carrier of that strep organism, but it didn't cause your sore throat. A lot of people don't know that that's possible, but in a family, when a kid gets a strep throat, the chances statistically are that 50% of the people in the family are going to get it or already are a carrier.
Yeah,
so you should always check the throats of other people. As a dad, you should.
Yes,
you may have heard
I've learned
that before.
This.
So that particular patient, I asked the mother, had there been anything back then, and she would know. Of course, it's years ago, and she didn't. And in the recent increase in his tics, was there anything? Because it can also cause a exacerbation, even in somebody who already has the disorder. Short of that, my attitude is quite different, and it goes something. And I say this to patients all the time. I said, you know, so you've been to lots of good people, and you've had a lot of tests, probably too many, but those were then, and this is now. And part of my approach is, so what, now what? And I don't mean so what in a nasty way.
Yeah.
I mean, so, doctor, I have this bad cough. Oh, so what? That's not what I mean.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, The so what is all the bazillion questions that doctors appropriately ask to get at the root of something. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they find out and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they do tests to a fault. Why does it do that? They will tell you that they do that because that's what they were taught to do and they want to get to the bottom of it and see if they can find everything out. Well, you know, a colleague of mine wrote a paper many years ago, really true. When you hear hoofbeats, think of zebras. So that's what doctors are taught. But part of this is because, and if you want to copy this paper, I can give it to you.
Yeah.
Part of it is because when she looked at 200 consecutive patients that had been referred to our clinic, there were three of us seeing patients that we referred specifically for hypnosis. 40 people had a previously unrecognized biological reason for their problem that had not been identified by competent clinicians who had seen them and referred them. Go see that guy for hypnosis. Go see that woman. She knows what she'll help you. Da da da. Including such obvious things as hyperthyroidism with eyes bulging out.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really the cause of that particular child's bedwetting problem.
Yeah.
Including other things. And I have a very famous famous amongst people who've been to my workshops.
Yeah.
Video. Talking with a young woman who is now a practicing PhD psychologist in this community. At the time, wow. she was 14 at the time. She had been to my partner for her headache problem. They didn't get anywhere. The mother, who was also a clinical psychologist, the patient's mother, came to talk to my partner, and they said, and they decided together that maybe she would benefit from talking to a male psychologist, a therapist instead. I'm not a psychologist, but would.
Yeah.
And the mother thought that was a good idea. So I met her, and I agreed. I suggested to her, because we happened by coincidence, if you believe in coincidence, we were in the process of preparing for a national behavioral pediatrics symposium that we had developed, a new learning method, and people were going to come from all over the country. We had all these big wigs from various places participating, and I was making one of the videos that was going to be used. And I thought, well, maybe this will be interesting. So I interviewed her, and it was videotaped. Mm-hmm. Right? And then we started working together and on her headaches that had no origin. That we knew of. You know, wasn't responding to migraine. Somebody had prescribed medicines for migraine, didn't touch it.
Mm-hmm.
There were all sorts of theories about it and so on. I saw her, I think, four times, taught her some biofeedback, some self-hypnosis. She improved, but she didn't get all the way better. She cut the frequency of her headaches in half. She cut the intensity of them by two-thirds. She was able to go back to school, though she had been missing school a lot. And as showing this video clip as an unknown to people in the conference.
Yeah.
Seven or eight small groups of six or seven people each, maybe more, maybe 10, each with a leaderless groups, and they were supposed to come up with their own formulation of it. And then they presented, each had a spokesman, and they presented their thoughts about it to the group. And then after each had presented their thoughts about it to the group, then one of the experts was invited to give a talk, did not know the outcome, and gave their theory. And the theory that this famous guy, now deceased, proposed, and he was one of my heroes as a writer and teacher, and I only met him when we invited him to teach there, said, well, I don't really know, and we haven't heard the end of it, but I don't... I have some theories. She has the kind of headaches, not terribly common. We know that it's not a brain tumor because in 95% of cases, by 4 months of a headache, it will show itself in some other symptoms, and she doesn't have that. And sometimes people with a brain tumor headache can point exactly to the space place that it is, which is very interesting. He says, and I'm not sure, but I am pretty confident, probably has something to do with her mother. and their relationship and blah, blah, blah. Okay. So at the time, now my memory is a problem because I don't remember at the time of the conference if we already knew the answer. Or I think we did, and then we revealed it, and everybody had egg on their face, including the professor. I think that's what happened, but maybe we didn't know until after. And every time I've shown it as an unknown at workshops, except for one time, no one, rookies, seasoned, veteran clinicians, no one came up with it except a resident in pediatrics in Switzerland when I was giving this talk in Switzerland, came up with the answer, and I'll tell you what he said in a minute. So here's what happened. She was getting better, and then she stopped getting better. And my partner said to her mother, you know, one thing that we haven't talked about is just look around the house and see if, for example, there was a new bleach or a new fabric softener or a new perfume or a new shampoo, something that was different that knew that maybe she started to use. There had been theories, like, for example, she didn't have the headaches when she went on vacation to Florida. So, well, maybe it's something to do with the house, you know, something like that. So she looked around and she didn't know what to do. So the mother decided to call Minigasco, the gas company, and the operator, the phone operator at Minigasco, listened to the story and said, well, honey, you got a gas leak. The technicians came to the house. The furnace pilot light was faulty. This was carbon monoxide poisoning. She would get better when she went out of the house because she'd wash out. Her bedroom was closer to the furnace room. In retrospect, other members of the family had very vague symptoms. Their bedrooms were on the upper floors. It wasn't a total, it was a flickering kind of pilot light thing because she could have been dead.
Yeah.
The whole family could have been dead. But totally amazing. So
should have invited the gas company woman to the conference.
Right, exactly. So, you know, so the logical question, so that, unfortunately, that sort of reality drives some of that negative, protective, defensive, I don't want to mess up, kill somebody behavior that doctors have in varying degrees. Yeah. But it is true. But the other reality, despite the title of the paper, the other reality is far and away, most of the time, 99.9% of the time, when you hear hoofbeats, they are horses, not zebras.
Yeah.
You know?
And the other interesting part of this case, though, too, is that you had, you know, significant success just from hypnosis and biofeedback.
But not complete success.
Right.
That's the hook.
Absolutely.
And the teaching point.
But I think just for me, you know, it also says, you know, if in a case where you know it is something that is still unsolvable, whether it's environmental or whether it's, you know, a relationship dynamic, maybe it is her mother. We don't always know those kinds of things, but to have some piece of control from the beginning does, you know, something in terms of the hope of the patient or of, you know, helping them believe that something can change, because that's another one of those pieces that I think people get stuck in. And this is another one of those reasons why I think, well, like things like what you do and, you know, what I do in some respects too is kind of helping people see what, you know, just a little bit better looks like.
Right. And providing comfort in the context so that, these are things I say to my patients too all the time, because the reality is, despite the fact that it's very hard to have these fill in the blank tics, headaches, anxiety, whatever you're dealing with, is very hard. The world really is not black and white. Most of the world is gray, and it's not just one kind of gray. It's all different shades.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to get away from the black and the white.
Yeah.
And get into how you modulate whatever it is that you experience.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
And that's why I'm in the now what. The so what, okay, we may never know how come those eye blinking started. And then I asked the other sort of question rhetorically. Says, would it be okay with you to be done with the tics even if you don't find out the reason for it? And the kids always say that's fine. And the parents are like, I want to know. Yeah, it's okay to want to know. But since we don't know yet, you could, if you were a billionaire, spend the rest of the next 10 years flying all over the world to every neck specialist, do all sorts of neck tests and blood and x-rays and God knows what. But in the meantime, wouldn't it be nice to feel better?
Yeah.
And to feel competent and to feel confident and to feel in control and to, because you can do that. So sometimes the naysayers about learning these skills say things like, aren't you going to mask something that's really important? No. It's never happened. I saw a girl once many years ago who was in a teenage clinic about a half a block from the children's hospital. That clinic no longer exists, so sorry to say. And she came in and she was a walking textbook of appendicitis from anybody with any experience saw her walking. She was hunched over. She was leaning to the right. She was clutching the lower right part of her belly. Now, that's not the only thing that does that. And she was a street kid, so she was by herself. She had come from a shelter for runaway youth and 17 years old, so a minor.
Yeah.
And for seeing anybody who wanted to be seen, and there were about 85% women and about 90% sexually transmitted diseases and pregnancy and other stuff like that.
Yeah.
She was different, but she needed an evaluation. She had never had a pelvic exam. I became an expert at that, not that day, but before that.
Yeah, you know?
And that, to me, confirmed the diagnosis. We didn't have to do any blood tests. We did do a blood count, and it was totally consistent with appendicitis. And I said, you have probably got appendicitis. You're going to need surgery. And between now and then, there's no reason for you to hurt now that you know what you need to know. And you can go back into that calm state you were in that we talked you through while you were having the pelvic exam so it wouldn't bother you. And there's no reason for there to be any discomfort or any more vomiting or anything between now and then. So it turns out that, sad to say, it took about 16 hours before she could get surgery because they had to get a court order and declare her ward of the court in order to have the necessary medical, because it was a medical emergency.
But no painkillers during this?
No painkillers, no vomiting. The surgeon, who didn't know about the hypnosis that preceded it, we had to go, even though it was only half a block. I insisted that she go by ambulance from there, not walk that half a block, because why? And the surgeon saw her and said, yeah, I agree, it's appendicitis, but I'm not going to touch this without the permission, you know, from the court. So thankfully, her appendix didn't rupture in the time of the might well have.
Right.
But she was pretty content, surprised so to the nurses. And then she had the surgery, and the surgeon wrote in the operative note, roaring appendicitis, appendix removed, stitched up, all the stuff they always write. Surprisingly little bleeding. Of course, that had been one of the hypnotic suggestions. You can really fake out the surgeon by having very little bleeding. Just bleed the right amount to keep the area moist while the surgeon operates. That makes it easier. And afterwards, you can be surprised how fast you heal and how hungry you are. Usually, people don't eat after surgery, but she was hungry. So it's all about expectation.
Yeah.
And it's all about comfort and providing expectation. The hypnosis did not mask the appendicitis, didn't prevent her from getting surgery. It facilitated the process.
Yeah.
And that's always the message, you know.
And it's so, you know, the one thing I picked up from that documentary, and I'm trying to, like, change the way I think about this idea of placebo, they talked about it as a positive mind state, as opposed to a negative mind state, which would be a nocebo or something, right? But the, you know, I've always thought about placebo as being like a neutral, and so, you know, I guess, you know, if there was, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but Dr. Eppelager, who coined the term craniosacral, which is the kind of work that I do, who he was an osteopath, and when he was asked sometime in the 80s at some conference how much of the work that he was doing was placebo, he said, you know, I don't really, you know, use that word. To me, that just is evidence of our ability to become creatively involved in our own healing process.
Right.
But it is that positive side of, you know, of that shift. And I imagine from a hypnosis or self-hypnosis point of view, we are trying to find the right kind of language, you know, both, I mean, you obviously with your patients, but, you know, in terms of like handing that off to people, it is a form of that then, correct?
It is. And the problem is that placebo has become its own worst enemy as a name.
Yeah.
So,
right.
So correctly so, people now teaching undergraduate courses in the placebo response and what it really means and things like that. So I think I don't use it unless it comes up. I don't even discuss it. But what I do talk about are expectations. And when we teach hypnosis workshops, we talk about the key features in any hypnotic experience being expectation and motivation. So if people have a problem and they have a positive expectation about getting it solved and they're motivated, they're going to be more effective more quickly in the context of a positive therapeutic alliance, right? Then the person is like, well, you know, he's probably not going to. That's what I thought was, well, fine, I'll go because my mom wants me to, but it's probably not going to do anything because nothing else has. And I jump right in and join with that and say, and that's probably true until and unless – you change your mindset because you really want to get better.
Yeah. And sometimes I think it's about controlling the environment for ourselves too.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's one of the things that's come up since the 2016 election is that we are in this, there's just a barrage going on between social media and news feeds and everything where, I mean, I've really, you know, controlled that environment for myself, and I, you know, not allowing stuff to be on my phone, you know, as one example, so that it, and to turning off, you know, alerts and all these different things, because those things can kind of ping your brain at any time and send you right into that, you know, into that place, which is really a hypnotic trigger that just keeps happening over and over again about things.
Yep, quite right. We don't really have to talk politics, do we?
No.
Oh,
I imagine that in your practice, as in mine, you know, I feel like it's normalized to some extent. I don't know if that's good or bad, but there was certainly a year there that I was dealing with a lot of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I don't always think about those things as all being bad, and part of it is I'm just a glass half full kind of person. But I also think that we sometimes have to go through those things and not avoid them either. You know, I think the feelings that people that were kind of, you know, being triggered, or people felt like they're being triggered, were things that, you know, they maybe weren't, you know, being fully aware of, that they should be more aware of too. And I think that's one of those pieces.
Yeah, and it's a challenge because there's no doubt about the reality that when you do pay attention to some of what's out there, it's pretty scary and unsettling, and you can either decide to buy into it and continue to feel that way, or you can think about alternatives and ways that go on about doing whatever you do that's meaningful to you.
And what I was kind of saying with all that, though, is not that I didn't want to get into the politics of it so much as like what we attach to, you know, in terms of that, you know, the language of all of that as well.
Yeah. I want to tell one other quick anecdote, although I don't want to steal the thunder. So I was talking to a colleague of mine the other day on the phone, and they told me that they had had a call out of the blue from a former patient from 40 years earlier.
Hmm.
That patient now being 57, 58 years old, 17 at the time.
Yeah.
At the time, the patient had a diagnosis of something called Ewing's sarcoma, which is a really bad cancer of muscle. And often the therapy is amputation. Typically it's in the legs, not always, but typically the treatment is amputation and chemotherapy, and that's usually followed in short order by death. A very, very lethal childhood cancer. And some who survive it develop a second cancer, different type, 10, 15 years later. Different type, but common. Second cancers are more common in everybody who has cancer, but not by any means predictable, and not all of them, and by any means, but not unusual. Certainly compared to the population who haven't had cancer.
Right.
But this person who called said, I was just thinking about you, and I just wanted to call you and tell you how I'm doing and how my life has been. And yeah, I've had some problems that were late effects of the chemo, and but I got through that, and I got through this, and I got through that, and I've been very successful. And I forget exactly what the profession is, but some business that he's been very successful businessman, the reason I'm alive is because of you, and the reason I'm alive is because of the self-hypnosis, and the reason I beat the cancer is because of self-hypnosis, and I use that in every way I can in my life, and thank you, and I love you. And I said, you got to publish that.
Yeah.
And you got to tell that story at our workshops.
And the fact that that he's stayed, this colleague of yours, that they've stayed as this positive piece for the last 40 years in this person's life is like incredible.
Yeah. Although I have to tell you, it's not unusual. I run into this all the time. I show to all new patients with hypnosis that we know we're going to do hypnosis. I show them a video that was made in 1991. What's that, 28 years ago?
Yeah.
That I didn't make. It was a professionally done video. The WCCO TV did it. They, at that time, all the TV stations locally had a TV doctor who was their consultant. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that. And they did a week-long series called Healing in the Mind as a five-minute segment on the 10 o'clock evening news.
Yeah.
And one of those segments was a very edited version of about an hour of taping with me and two different patients, one a 14-year-old boy with migraine and another a 6-year-old girl with warts, a relentless wart on the bottom of her foot. She had it cut, frozen, wart away, and other stuff. And every time that treatment was given, it worked. And every time the wart reappeared, because warts are, after all, caused by viruses.
Yeah.
She learned self-hypnosis with mothers on camera saying, well, I don't know. I was skeptical. I figured, what the heck? Nothing else worked.
Yeah.
And she did self-hypnosis every 6 years old. She did self-hypnosis every day for 10 minutes for 6 weeks. The wart disappeared, hadn't come back. This video was done a year after. So a year follow-up, no recurrence of the wart. And the research is very clear about warts are caused by a virus. And the research is very clear that hypnosis is as effective as any other treatment, the difference being that in hypnosis, far and away, most of the time when you get rid of warts by hypnosis, they don't recur. Nobody knows why.
Yeah.
We think it's an immune phenomenon. It must be because this is a virus. But that's the way it is.
Yeah.
The other one, the 14-year-old boy, the narrative is something like on the order of at the beginning of it, when he first came, he was having headaches several times a week. And by the end of four visits, they were down to once a month. And then they disappeared. And some years after that, I did this research study and sent questionnaires to all the patients who I had seen for headaches. And it was anonymous. And there was a page at the end that was blank that said, if you have anything else you want to say that we haven't asked you, blah, 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 please let us know. And he wrote, his imagery was playing golf because he's a golfer. So they went to a golf course with him that station did and filmed him golfing.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So he writes in his note, I know this is anonymous, but I just wanted to check in with you. I'm the guy from the golf video. duh, so I knew who it was. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to thank you again because I haven't had a headache since that video. And later I had wish you luck in the survey. And then about, several years later, I had a call or email maybe from the mother, his mother, who said, you said that I could get a copy of that video, so I'd like that if you don't mind. I just want you to know that he's married, he has three children, and he has never had a headache since he saw you.
Yeah.
So that's the same situation, and that's much more common than not. The results of that survey, which are published, are to a person stories about how they transferred that skill to other aspects in their life, how they helped them in surgery, how they helped them in their dance class, how they helped them in all sorts of other things. And all of them were much better, if not resolved, with their headaches. Nobody stayed the same. Nobody got worse. And that was really the first paper to be published in the hypnosis literature of long-term follow-up.
Yeah.
Would it were that we'd have that for all of our patients,
right.
But that takes money,
and it's hard. Exactly, it takes money, and it's hard to keep up with all these people too.
Yeah.
But the part of the reason that I wanted to talk to you is I think what you're hitting on here is really challenges people's belief system of how much do we actually have power over our physiology,
Right.
And I think it's one of those. It to me it feels like the direction that medicine's going. Even though we from a physiological standpoint and getting down to the cellular level, we know a certain amount and we know how to interact with certain kinds of things. At the same time, we are as that again that documentary sort of pointed out, we are from that level of our atomic beings. We are when it comes to space and energy, we are mostly space in our atoms.
And the biology is better. So for. Yeah. For people who are interested in knowing that biology, I'll just give a plug. They can look up anything written by Dr. Amir, A-M-I-R, Raz, R-A-Z.
Okay.
He's a neuropsychologist, neurophysiologist. He's now has a research center in California. I forget exactly where, but you can find him on Google.
Okay.
And he's done some of the most important research in hypnosis with PET scans.
I'll have to check that out. Sounds right at my alley.
And so-called functional MRI studies where people in the scanner real time are given hypnotic suggestions, and this is measured, and you can see it happening in the brain. So there's no doubt about the reality of this is not sham stuff,
Right.
And thankfully now from his work, and he's an incredible speaker. If you ever have an opportunity to hear him speak, he's a... And the funny part is, I won't spoil his show if you ever see him speaking. He's an American now, but he began as an Israeli. And when he was a teenager, he learned magic so that he could do magic at birthday parties and stuff and make some money.
Yeah.
So he's a very incredibly accomplished magician. And he often uses that as part of an intro talk about hypnosis.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's really fascinating stuff.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for doing this again with me. And if you have any more ideas for follow-ups in the future, you can contact me this time.
Okay, it sounds good. I'd be happy to do it. Thanks for asking me.
It's a pleasure. All right, thank you. Dr. Dan, hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. I got so much from listening back to this one. Since our first conversation a couple years ago with Dr. Dan, I've thought a lot about the use of language. If you're a regular listener, you probably know that I was an English major as an undergrad and continued to take writing courses after that. It's been an incredibly helpful tool language has in my practice. And what I'm reminded of, again, in this conversation is that the words we use and say to ourselves are one of our most powerful forms of medicine. Informing the brain, words are the seeds being planted. They can turn into something beautiful with tending and ongoing support, but the wrong words can grow into weeds that overcrowd the garden that we wish to grow. I'm ever so grateful to Dr. Dan for taking the time to do another one of these with me. Let me know what you thought of this topic and conversation. You can email me at jeremy@highwaytohealthpodcast.com. And don't forget to take a minute if you haven't already to rate this podcast and give it a review. It may turn someone new onto the podcast searching for resource and inspiration. Thanks for listening. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.